Hello, hello. This is Osman Parvez with House Einstein, and this is House Einstein podcast number 17. With me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello.
And we are licensed real estate agents in the state of Colorado with a brokerage called House Einstein. And this podcast, here's our standard disclaimer of sorts. This podcast is entertainment for you. This is not legal advice. This is not real estate advice or financial advice or even spiritual or dating advice. This is advice that is
this
only...
This is entertainment.
Thank you. This is entertainment. If you are our client, a client with House Einstein or with me specifically, reach out to me and directly communicate with me for advice regarding your specific real estate situation. Otherwise, this podcast is entertainment only. And that should keep the attorneys happy. All right.
Sweet. Well, we have kind of a mixed bag of topics today. One's a little follow-up from a previous podcast.
Yeah. So we'll give you a quick overview of what we're going to talk about in this podcast. We're going to talk about construction and construction defects. We're going to talk about Compass specifically and their private client network and the truth about pocket listings and whether that's an effective method for marketing your home. What else are we talking about, Hamish? We are talking about, I think we should start with this, the sadness we feel in losing our intern for the summer, Grant Gardner, who is currently driving across the country, headed back to Georgia, and who killed it as an intern. We were so grateful to have him be part of the team, the level of professionalism with him. I guess I'll just start with that.
Yeah.
Grant was a surprise. I wasn't looking for an intern. I met with one of his family members, and it was on a different topic entirely. It was about the process for remotely managing your home if you're going to travel the world for a year or two. How do you manage your property? Should you short-term rent it? Should you not rent it at all? Should you do a long-term rental? That's what the original topic was. And then I learned that Grant was coming back for the summer and was looking for an internship with a commercial real estate firm and had a real interest in history and financial analysis. And I said, well, you know, we could probably come up with something for this gentleman. Send me a resume. And Grant did. And the resume was really impressive.
Insane.
We had an interview, maybe two interviews, and he killed both interviews. And it was a no-brainer. So we did hire him as a paid intern for the summer. And he added value to every single agent on the team. And it was a team decision. He did work with Ian and he did work with Sophie as well. He even helped us get our merch order done, which I really appreciate. So maybe he'll come back next summer. We'll see. It would be great to see him again.
Grant revisited.
Grant part two. So yeah. Grant, if you're listening, thank you. He also took charge of transcribing our podcasts, which will be published on our blog, on our webpage, our blog, sometime in the near future for those that prefer the written form and also for searchability for Google and other search engines for AI to find the content. We need to get the transcripts on our webpage, on our blog.
Oh yeah. And we can, thanks to Grant.
Thanks to Grant. We can do that and can hopefully continue to do that. We've got kind of a backlog at this point, given this is podcast number 17. So, all right. So that's what we led with. I think the other really big piece of news, we'll save the Compass, salacious Compass stories for the end.
And we're mentioning by name on Compass.
I am, because I don't really see a way to talk about how they are. All right. Well, we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
We're going to talk about that because generally speaking, we have a rule in our podcast and in our life. I do. And I have a rule that I share with Hamish frequently. I share it with the rest of the team as well, although I can't control what they do with their lives. But we generally don't criticize by name. We criticize by category and we praise by name. But in this particular instance, I don't really see how we can talk about this situation without talking about how Compass is marketing pocket listings.
Their whisper network.
And I'm hearing about it from my clients. And so it's worth talking about what the truth is with regard to that. But before we jump into that, we're going to save that and encourage you to listen to the whole podcast. Let's talk about some other big news on a personal front. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about something big that happened recently.
I recently closed on my first house. I think we brushed on this when Grant was doing our interview podcast 16. It's a 4-bed, 3-bath ranch with a basement. It's about 2,000 square feet, plus or minus, you know, 100 or so square feet. Built in 73. It's along the Front Range, kind of right by Stanley Lake. I'll get that close to the location with it. And I am finding out firsthand the joys of home ownership without actually being in the home yet and enjoying it yet.
Well, what do you mean by that, Hamish?
Yeah, exactly. So it's an older home. And I was thinking about this on the way on a drive the other day. And, you know, a lot of people, turnkey homes are extremely sought after and valuable and kind of have a certain air about them. And they may be turnkey when you move in, and some other ones, you know, you decide you're going to do a little upgrade and you end up on a rabbit hole and you're moving in a day. And the house currently has black mold and just ended asbestos. So complete recap here. We closed on the 7th. And since then, I've had this rental that I'm staying at now paid through to the end of July. And the idea was to do a few upgrades, maybe some cosmetic things, get the house a little bit prettied up, and then begin the move process. And our first step was insulating the attic. The attic, before we did this upgrade, had about R18, some blown-in insulation, and then later we found out that it also had some fiberglass, maybe asbestos, underneath the blown-in. So we ordered from Home Depot, bulk ordered some R30. The day to install was Saturday last week. And we were doing a walkthrough up in the rafters to kind of get a lay of the land before we started the whole process. And a good friend of mine, Ben, fell through the roof. He fell through in the hallway, and it ended up actually being kind of like a silver lining to the install of the attic insulation, because at the same time we could kind of like double team this, you know, there were two access points for us to go up and down. We had two different places to hand up the rolls and kind of roll everything out. So, I mean, I'm a little thankful for this hole, but at the same time, a house in 73, you bet there's popcorn ceilings.
And lead-based paint. So hold on, let's back up a little
bit. Yeah.
Tell me what it felt like buying your first home. What was that like for you?
Yeah, especially the process, right? Because we had the showing. This house was fairly original. The kitchen's been somewhat updated. The bedrooms are pretty standard. I wouldn't say there's anything characteristically amazing about them. Same with the bathrooms. It's all fairly like, I'll call it like 2008 finishes upstairs. And downstairs appeared to have a very recent remodel. The floor had kind of been redone. There's a bathroom that still had drywall dust on the bathtub, you know, like had just been put in. And I go on the showing. I take a look. It fits all of the functional requirements. I'll have two adult roommates. You know, everybody should have their own bathroom, things like that. And we put in an offer. It's a great offer. Should I talk about the offer?
If you'd like to. I'll jump into the offer. What was the secret sauce in your, how was your offer competitive? What did you do?
So I'd previously been beaten out in a property in Broomfield, and we ended up finding out that there were 18 competing offers in that home. And one of the things that we'd done on that offer was look around in kind of the neighborhood at past sales and see at that price point how over asking these houses went for, to try and craft something competitive, because, you know, you're in this price point, I'm in around like $500,000 mark, and there's incredible demand. It's very typical to have multiple offers at that price point, especially for these homes that are turnkey, air quotes for those without video. So there's kind of like some competition there, and I jumped in, we wrote this offer. The house is on Dover Street. we're just getting into the location now. We wrote this offer for the Dover Street house, and I did my quick analysis. And this neighborhood is right next to where I'm currently living. It's 2 minutes away. So neighborhood, that already checked the boxes. So I do my quick analysis, and I think what really set it aside is we had a short inspection window, so only a week to get this inspection sorted, objects to things, have the resolution, all of that. And then also I added an escalation clause. I noticed that within this neighborhood, houses at that price range within the year had been going for typically, I was really hopeful it would only be five over, but the range was 5 to 20 over ask. For this price point, similar features, but not necessarily the same. And so we put in an escalation. It would escalate by $2,500 over whatever the competing bona fide offer was up until $520,000. And we ended up getting a bona fide offer. So we got pushed right up to $519,000. But that really, I wouldn't even been considered because I think our initial offer was right on $500,000 or $505,000.
That was our starting point. That's right.
Yep, exactly. So there were three other offers. We beat out the top offer and ended up on a contract. So, I mean, that's my deal. So we can talk about all the details.
Sure. So a couple of things. Hamish has been with House Einstein now for 18 months or so.
And getting there.
Relatively newly licensed agent. And most agents and nationwide do 3 or 4 deals a year. I think the average, last time I checked for Boulder County, was 3.5 deals per year for the average agent. And as part of supporting me and Ian and Sophie, Hamish has been exposed to probably on the order of 30 deals a year.
Yeah.
And maybe even more than that. That might be a conservative estimate. And that means helping draft those deals, checking those deals for errors, seeing how they're negotiated. So when he says he did a little analysis, it's a little analysis based on more deals than the average agent does in a decade is what you're probably looking at. So that's a lot of deal. Actually, I'm sure it's more deals than the average agent does in a decade based on the math. So that's 10 years of experience in 18 months on how real estate negotiations go. And three different agents that are full-time focused on real estate deals. So a little analysis goes a long way. And and understanding the what's been getting deals done and how to write an offer without giving up the farm in terms of contingencies is important. But you got the house, right? And
yeah.
So the escalation clause helped. The company chipped in a little bit. That helped. But you got the That's house, fair. And then, well, what happened next?
The emotion. I have a bunch of exposure to all the deals that we've been working on at House Einstein. And the exposure isn't just, it is writing these contracts and everything, but it's putting my head and kind of my mind entirely into these deals, even though I'm not the agent on file, right? The focus and the attention to detail requires you to have your head fully in the game. So that experience, I believe, truly comes across. That said, I'm a fairly modest person. And so I like my experience and I like my skill set, though I'll never trust myself 100%. I don't say things with certainty. So we go under contract and the whole time in the back of my head, I'm like, we need to get this inspection done. I had to have missed something. This was way too easy, right? That we talk about the buyer mentality where if there's no pushback or anything, and there was on the contract, but there wasn't anything on the showing that screamed red flag. So I was like, there has to be a ball that's going to drop. There has to be another shoe that's going to come down.
So you did your inspection.
Yes.
And despite writing in quite some language around not, and actually these were serious issues. So we wrote in some language that signals to the seller that you're a serious buyer and you're not going to object to cosmetic and trivial issues just to claw back the price, that you're going to buy this house unless there's some real deal killers. And we did find some. Remember, there was aluminum wiring. What was the other one?
The gas leak.
And both of these issues, the seller
and radon.
Correct. And radon. Yep. They agreed to credit you, I think, for the radon.
No, they just took care of the gas leak and the aluminum wiring.
Okay.
Which was
fine. They took care... which was fine. And in line with how you wrote the contract, they were maybe, I would even say, a little bit generous. They could have played hardball. They didn't. They wanted to close the deal.
Easily.
Okay. So
not to mention, go ahead.
No, what's not to mention?
Quick sidebar. So I had an estimate come in for the aluminum wiring that was right around $4,600. And then I also had a friend come and bid it out, and that bid out to, I think, around 2000. I got the invoice from the listing agent of the work done, and he only paid like $1,500. I want his electrician. Yeah. I don't know how that pencils out.
Cheapest is not always the answer, but it's really nice. And let's keep that electrician on file. So I should back up a little bit. Aluminum wiring is a potential safety risk in that, when these homes were constructed during the Vietnam War, there was a shortage of copper, and aluminum expands and contracts more than copper does. And so you end up, when the temperatures change, you could end up with gaps in where the wiring connects to outlets and junction boxes, light fixtures, and that could potentially be a fire risk. So aluminum wiring is mitigated. Usually this is the approach. People don't rip out all the wiring. They just install pigtailing usually. They mitigate it or remediate it with pigtailing, which is a technique to bond the aluminum and the copper much more strongly together.
Exactly. And so that's what happened on this house. And I actually reached out to Ian. He this year had a deal with a similar kind of situation. And so I used the same electrician to bid that out. And that was, it's really cool being within the brokerage. You know, you can reach out and say, you had this, how did that work out? So resolution comes along.
Just point of reference for bidding. This is why you get three estimates. For the same job, licensed electricians, $1,500, $2,000, and $4,500. You have a 200% variation in bidding. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. Hopefully the $1,500 guy did a good job, but this is why you always get multiple estimates. And we've seen this sort of variability with all of the properties we own and manage, as well as that we've helped our clients get issues resolved. There's huge variability in quality and pricing, and you have to get estimates
absolutely
to really know what the market is for that particular job.
Yeah. So they also, I think the sellers were actually very kind. And on top of remediating or mitigating the aluminum wiring, they also replaced every single outlet in the house and updated all the GFIs. And I think they kind of went above and beyond in taking care of it, which was, it was great to see. They also took care of a few other things that came up on inspection that I wasn't really concerned about. They cut down a tree that was next to the foundation. They fixed a few broken locks and just, you know, little kind of creature comforts that you really wouldn't have had to. And I really, that was appreciated.
Yeah, that's why we sent them the whole inspection report, and they went above and beyond and addressed things that we didn't even ask or didn't object to. Yeah, that's great. I mean, look, that's really the experience you want the buyer to have, is that, okay, you got an inspection report. In addition to the things you are objecting to, we're going to deal with X, Y, and Z because we're rock stars and we want you to get a home that has these things addressed. You know, that experience as a buyer, you feel really good about. And it's not just karma. There are reasons to keep the deal positive and with good communication, because if something does go sideways, having that basis of goodwill and trust makes it a simple issue to resolve, because trust is already there versus if you act shady on either side, but particularly for the seller, the moment you start acting shady, you know, the buyer's worried. They're making a huge financial commitment to an asset, and they're taking on the risk of ownership of this asset, which if there's uncertainty, like the nightmare scenarios start to spiral in your head. So all of that was well and good. But then what happened, Hamish? You closed. So,
exactly. We closed. I saw the inspection report, nothing major. I'm thinking, let's get energy efficient. Let's bring down utility cost per month. So I put together this huge project. Saturday is the day. All my friends are coming around. We've got snacks. We've got food. We're going to do the roof. Ben falls down the roof and opens up the second window for us to add insulation. That's great. But now we've kind of released asbestos into the air with the popcorn ceiling. And on the same day, we get somebody out to kind of give us a quote running down the asbestos mitigation. That quote came in really affordable as a friend of a friend, now my friend at this point, because he's just been completely stellar. And the next day, Saturday, we do the insulation, actually without a hitch. You can tell it made a difference already in the temperature. I very much recommend that. It's a great feeling. And it's tax creditable, as I found out, until like 2035. Do your own research.
I'm glad to hear that you had a good experience with this guy. And then we can add this person to our contractor list, because I do have an asbestos person, but he was like the least of the bad. They all showed up in, you know, big 3/4 ton or full ton, full dress pickup trucks and fancy outfits. He had like crocodile skin boots and those asbestos guys make a lot of money, and the variability of the pricing on the last bid was huge too. So knowing that you've got somebody that does good work and charges reasonable rates is super useful. So we'll keep that guy on file.
Absolutely. He does asbestos mold, and just really environmental abatement, from all of our past good ideas that turned out to cause cancer as home builders. So he's there. We're taping up for the ceiling scrape on Sunday, planning to get it knocked out within the week. And this is all very fresh, so I might not have processed all the details quite yet. So we're there on Sunday taping up, and I'm like, hey, man, come down and check out this carpet. It kind of sinks into the ground. I'm not too sure. And we pull it up, and the tack strip on the carpet in the basement on the window well side is basically non-existent. It's in pieces and is completely black and looks as though moisture has made it in. So Alex is there. He's in abatement mode, right? We've just taped up a bunch of stuff. We're getting ready. We're already kind of in it, as it were. So we just immediately tape up a section of the wall, cut through the drywall, and start ripping out drywall. And lo and behold, there's a massive patch of black mold that extends, I'll say, like 2 feet up from the floor, and then it's a good 7 feet wide. It extends underneath the window well out maybe 6 inches on the left side of the window well, and then it goes all the way to the wall on the right, and then inward on the other wall by about another 16 inches.
Kind of so how are you stuff. Feeling, Hamish, when this was being cut out of your house and the discovery was happening of... in your beautifully finished basement, you're now that you just bought, you're now sawzalling out or cutting out drywall and nasty carpet.
Not only this, but keep in mind we're planning on moving and having people occupying this bedroom on the 22nd. So it's like
tomorrow.
Tomorrow. You know, if you're going through hell, keep going. Is kind of the mentality. And at this point, right, we'd already been in a sweltering attic. We've dealt with a falling through the ceiling and drywalling that up, and we've already dealt with asbestos. So my mindset really was like, I don't care. And we reference car things a lot to house things. And this is, to me, extremely relatable to cars. You'll go in for a job, and as you go in, you'll see that bushing needs work, and that bolt's stripped, and this is leaking, and that needs help. And it becomes
especially with BMWs, older BMWs, as you like to own.
Calling out the brand, I see how it is. especially actually, BMWs leak like it's their job. So, you know, I used to, when I was working on cars and like I have my project cars, I would get extremely overwhelmed as the task list starts piling up. And it's one of those, I purchased this house, I'm closed on it. There's no backing out now. There's that in the back of the head thing where it's like, could I come back on the sellers? You know, could I do something there? And one, being so close to these contracts, you kind of know your outs and your ins, and you know these things. So I knew there wasn't really any reasonable cause to go back.
Well, what do you mean? Like recourse with the seller?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
I mean, it's like did the seller know? Did they hide it? Were they being so nice because they knew they had this time bomb in the basement called Black Mold?
Right.
And you're like, well, can I go after them if they didn't disclose it?
Exactly. Wow. And yeah. Well, and then that lead, the suspicion rose because the bathroom in the basement had been remodeled and it had all been painted at the same time. So you're like, well, okay, if they just did the basement bathroom and everything's repainted the same, then maybe they just redid the whole basement. And so I'm in the basement, ripped out the drywall, and there's black mold. And it's like, well, this, if you add two and two together at this point, sure, it looks like the seller covered this up. I don't think so. Yeah,
can you,
right.
Can
maybe.
You prove it? I mean, the
you
insulation
can't.
Says 2015.
Yeah.
We had the wettest year that Colorado has seen in
decades.
Many decades.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Insulation said 2015, and then the drywall is dated 2011. The walling in, however it happened, I'm under the firm belief that it happened much before the sellers listed to sell. It sounds
like if the insulation is 2015 and the drywall is 2011, it sounds like the installer used old drywall that they had.
I imagine there was some spare parts there, right? Back to cars.
When you buy this stuff in bulk, you store it and you end up with a warehouse of stuff. So
yeah.
Okay.
Right. Though, you know, with like how much demand there is for housing and things like that, I think it's unreasonable to assume that this was just installed. I really do. Yeah. I think, the quality of finish and everything on this. Go ahead.
I mean, the alternative, right? There are two kind of possibilities. One is that the seller cut out old drywall and re-put it back on to install insulation again.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this leaked before. Let's be suspicious and paranoid.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It
let's
leaked
do that.
Before. And they cut it, you know, perfectly on the drywall edges, on the edges that line up with the studs. So now you can easily screw back in the old piece of drywall that carefully removed it. And then they replaced the insulation, mitigated it, put the drywall back up, and called it good. I mean, you do have two different conflicting dates there. But here's what, you know, even if you think that's true.
Right.
Going after the seller, it require hiring an attorney, would require multiple years, probably, if you're actually going to go through this whole process, but more than likely would be settled. And it would be very difficult to prove that they actually hit it. And the contract is pretty clear that you're buying the house as is, where is.
Mm-hmm.
But the seller is required to disclose what they know. And I don't think, this is my opinion, and it's not a legal opinion, but this is what I tell my clients that want to sell a house. And, well, this is entertainment, but this is what I'll tell my clients, that disclose what you know, maybe over-disclose to some extent. You're usually better off to go in that direction than to not disclose. And your decision to not provide a seller's property disclosure does not absolve you from your duty to disclose. And we recently had a deal in Table Mesa where they played this game where we don't know anything, we're not going to disclose. I'm like, okay, well, you're a real estate agent.
Mm-hmm.
And you're an owner. Like, you're double required to disclose what you know. So
yeah.
You're not providing an SPD. In my mind, it actually increases your liability because you were
definitely
still required to disclose. And I don't know who gives people advice to not provide an SPD, but you actually got an SPD.
I
seller's
did.
Property disclosure, but it didn't list anything like this.
And an additional detail, this was an estate sale, essentially, right? As the surviving estate, or I'm not sure the correct way to talk about it, but whoever owned the home passed. So that's like almost an additional layer of obscurity and protection for the seller of saying, we don't know, because the guy who did all the work is no longer around.
And the legal entity that owned the home was an LLC.
Yeah. So it's
in theory, if they've actually listened to their legal advisor, they maintained a degree of separation that's required between the LLC and their personal finances.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what other assets are in the LLC, but if they're smart, there are no other assets in the LLC. When I worked for an investment firm in Denver, every single deal was in its own LLC.
Wow.
And if you're a home flipper, you do this too. because you want to limit your liability. I mean, it's called a limited liability company for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so that's to prevent you from going after the people that are members of the LLC, if and only if they maintained a degree of separation between themselves financially and the LLC. So there's so this is called piercing the corporate veil if you try to go after them personally, and it's another barrier for you to potentially have recourse with the seller.
Right. So that's in the back of my head, right? Is there recourse for me? Can I go back? I told my grandpa about this yesterday or the day before, and he's immediately like, well, can you sue? Can you still get out of the contract? And I just thought that was funny.
I already own the house, grandpa. Sorry, not an option anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, the wheels are already rolling.
I have a big loan.
Yeah.
And I have a big mortgage payment, and unwinding, reversing all of that,
it would cost way more than.
Well, you would be walking away from your equity and then suing, and it would just be a couple thousand dollars worth of expenses.
So that's the kicker, right? So that's in the back of my head. But then we'd done a little bit of drywall patching because of the hole in the roof. So we kind of know what's involved in doing some drywall. We've done insulation because we messed around in the attic, and you know, you do a little research before you buy. And so, yeah, there's black mold, and I ripped out some drywall. But at the end of the day, that's kind of a little DIY garage project. So that's in the back of my head. But I'm like, there still hasn't been anything, and a knock on wood. And I don't, you know, we've inspected everything even more so now that we can get invasive with it and we own the property. Yeah. And there still really isn't any major red flags. So like, black mold sucks, but it's so cool that we caught it now instead of moved in and then down the road, you know, Brad has bronchitis and is chronically
health
sick.
Issues.
Exactly. Right.
So it's always better to catch it early. And in a dry climate like Colorado, normally a dry climate, mold is not as big of an issue because everything dries out, mold needs moisture to grow. And it can be addressed. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a great house. And every deal, every home has surprises when you finally move in. And I'm grateful you guys caught it early. This is still very fresh and still actively happening.
Yep.
So I will add, and this again is not mold mitigation advice or construction advice. This is based on experience and it's entertainment. But the first and foremost thing is, all right, get all the bad material out, mm-hmm. and then figure out where is the source of the water. And then stop the water issue from happening again, and then reinstall the new materials that are not mold containing. And you should be good to go. But every house I have ever seen that's over 50 years old has some water leak that happens somewhere, because our homes have indoor plumbing, and mm-hmm. plumbing fails. Even nice copper fails over time. It can corrode. PEX can fail. A kitchen sink can start leaking. A bathroom supply line can go. The dishwasher can leak. The fridge can leak. I mean, we're putting water in every darn thing and throughout the house. So at some point, you're going to have water that's going to leak. It's not a question of if. It's just a question of when. And then it's a question of, are you going to do the right thing and get rid of the moisture source and fix it right? And then
exactly.
And that's what you should do.
And it's cars. It's cars. I keep losing power steering fluid, so I'm going to go in there. I'm going to look and see if I can identify the leak. If I can't, I'm going to remove things and clean it up, right? Stop the power steering leak and then put in new things. It's the same thing with this water coming into the basement. And I say coming in as though it's actively happening. Here's where we're at now. We've done the demo. We've pulled back the insulation. We've pulled back the drywall. In doing so, I believe it's called a stud, but it's not vertical. It lays horizontally across the ground. Is that still a stud?
I think they're normally, it's like, could be called the floor plate. Okay. You're talking about the stud that's horizontal on the ground that should be treated lumber, but wasn't.
Yes.
If it's touching concrete on the floor, it should be treated. I don't, you know, I'm not a carpenter, but I don't know if you call that a stud. I think that might be the floor plate, but it's the same idea.
We've described it to this point.
That's horizontal. Yeah.
Yeah, that was still wet to the touch. And being wet to the touch and the wall, oh, wow, you should have seen the efflorescence on this wall. We had like an inch thick of that crystalline limestone that comes out when the wall's been wet. Apparently, it glows
in the dark.
Which
also tells you it's not new. If you've got an inch thick efflorescence coming out of the concrete, that's an old leak.
Right. And so they, you know, the foundation issues are rife in this area, kind of all along the Front Range. And your mind kind of jumps to the worst thing. We ran through a few kind of possibilities. Maybe the water is coming from the groundwater. Maybe the water is coming from the main water line. And that actually might still have some basis of truth, or maybe it did at some point, because the main water line coming into the house is PEX with shark bite fittings. And I spoke about this with my superintendent friend. He showed his boss, and his boss just laughed.
I wouldn't use shark bite anywhere you can't easily access it, access it, but I'm not a plumber. I did reach out to an inspector who is a friend, a colleague, and he's going to stop by on Sunday and actually offer you a freebie and take a look at it. But he said PEX is not against code in the ground.
No, surprisingly.
It can be used in the ground, which surprised me, but shark bite I would not expect to see, but I don't know if that's plumbing code or not. It just screams do it yourself. Yeah. And save money.
But on the water main, I mean, into the house.
In the dirt, next to the foundation that requires excavation to reach.
Yeah.
Would you use something that's difficult to get to? Would you use something that may or may not have a higher failure rate? And, you know, people, the plumbers seem to hate shark bite, but others say it's fine and it's a 25 to 30 year product and you're good to go.
It's a controversial fitting, you know?
Plumbers hate it, this one trick. They don't like it.
we're doing this diagnosis. And the moment we do the demo, see the wet stud on the ground, I throw in an air handler. I open the window. I seal off that room and just let it kind of ventilate. Colorado's got a low relative humidity. It should dry out. Next day I come by, it's dry to the touch. All of the visible moisture has evaporated. It's just kind of like a damp stud at this point. And we're running through, right? We're talking about groundwater. We're talking about a main water line and cars too. Often the most simplest answer is the answer. And I'm not saying we have this figured out yet, but it stands to reason that this metal window well and window and metal buck is letting in water. The grade outside of the house isn't perfect. It came up on the inspection. I think it was still not an orange item. The inspection company we used does these color codes. The grade isn't perfect. The window itself isn't actually sealed into the opening in the basement either. I've pulled it out and climbed out to show that you can still leave even though it's not egress. There's also kind of some gaps around the window buck itself. That makes sense, right? Like, of course, it's come through there. It's been super wet.
Yeah. It sounds like dry it all out, non-expansive foam and caulk to fill all the gaps around the window. Mm-hmm. You may want to cut out that lower stud, the one that's horizontal, and up, and all the ones that got wet and show signs of mold. Sister on new lumber. Mm-hmm. Make sure the one that's touching the concrete on the bottom is treated lumber, that little piece that's 7 feet wide.
Crucial.
And then treat the stuff with kills as well, maybe to double protect yourself from mold growth, and then put it back together and maybe leave a couple of inches of drywall exposed, not covering the studs to see if it gets wet again. And don't finish it. Install it with drywall screws, the piece of drywall you've cut out, and just give it a few months.
Seams.
And don't even tape the seams.
Okay.
Just wait. Don't tape the seams. Wait. Give it 6 months. And if you have no water in 6 months, then it's time to unscrew all the drywall screws, pull that 7 foot piece off, put the insulation back, new insulation, and then rescrew on the drywall and cover that little strip access port to check on it. And then you should be good. Mm-hmm. You solved it, but for sure, find the source of water. Got to solve it.
Yeah. And that's, it's enough to remove some mold and put it back on. But if you don't treat the root cause, you're just making Band-Aids.
That's right.
And I think
Home ownership.
Welcome. What an intro
to your adventure in home ownership. You can't call the landlord for this.
Nope. That's me. Just all this to say is it's been an incredible push. I'm actually extremely grateful for all the friends and connections that I have to make this a possibility. Otherwise, it would be not affordable and not possible in the timeline that we have. It's looking like we'll have carpet in that room this weekend. This weekend's also our big move date. So the next time we do a podcast, I'll be in a different room. And it's looking like it's all going to come together quite nicely, surprisingly.
Yeah.
On wood again.
That's a nice cherry on top for the story of the acquisition of your first home, your first home purchase. And it's great to have friends in the business. They can save you a lot of money. It's great to be in the business and have those relationships with contractors of all kinds, including this inspector, mm-hmm. who's not the one that inspected your house, but happy to come by tomorrow on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And give you some thoughts on what might be causing this leak. But he did share with me that he has seen more wet basements this year than he's ever seen in his career.
Right.
So it's super common. And it's really good that you're getting ahead of it. And welcome to homeownership.
Hey, I'll tell you when I'm glad to be here. So far, I'm excited for it. But right now, it's just a lot of DIY.
My first 2 years in the business, we didn't own a home here in Boulder. And it was always something I felt this degree of shame around. I don't know why, but we were renting. And meanwhile, I'm helping people buy, mostly buyers, a few listings. And I always tried to keep it on the DL. They're like, oh, where's your house? And I say, we live in, and it was Martin Acres. We live in Martin Acres, but I wouldn't tell them our house is in Martin Acres because that's a lie. It's not our house. It's our rental house. I guess it's still our house, but it's not quite as clean as
But I share that Martin with Acres. You too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Getting yeah, this I felt the place. Sense,
it changes your perspective. And I felt like it finally established me. And you're like 7 years ahead of when I bought my first house. So congratulations on locking it down. And
thank you.
And I'm sure it'll come up again in future podcasts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're going to talk. I've got a bunch of plans for it on top of mitigation. And we'll be hitting probably a lot of subject points. I'm a very strong DIYer. So... you know, I'll be discussing a lot of strategies.
Yeah.
Ethernet is going to be one of the larger things in making the home a modern home.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. All right. So we move on to our topic du jour, the one that was kind of the saucy topic of the podcast.
I think so. I think we've beat this one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about pocket listings again. Now, this is a revisit to podcast 7, I believe, when we talked about the truth about pocket listings. So here's the story. This week I was at lunch with a past client, and this past client, I love our clients. I feel this massive sense of trust that they've bestowed on us, and we often end up being friends. And this client really resonated with me personally. And it's been unfortunate that it's been so long since we've hung out, but they've decided for a variety of reasons that they want to be back in California, and they acquired a home in California, and they're likely going to be moving out of that house here in Boulder sometime toward the end of the summer and maybe even later. And then they may rent out the house that they bought here in Boulder, or they may sell it. Ultimately, they're probably going to sell it because they don't really want to deal with being a landlord. And we had this kind of discussion about the real estate industry because the agent that represented them in California was a Compass agent and got them in to see a listing that was supposedly only for Compass people. And they ended up buying that listing before it officially hit the market. And his concern, he said, and he was very honest about this. He's like, Osman, I may choose a different brokerage to list the house because I'm a little concerned that you guys are so boutique. You're not going to have the footprint we need to market our high-end listing here in Boulder. And, you know, I really appreciate honesty from people, and it's not a personal thing. And I told him that I'm okay with that. It's not personal. If you feel like you're going to get better service from a different brokerage, you can go with that. It's not going to affect our friendship. But I also want you to know the truth about how it works in the real estate business. And there is so much in this business that is done under the illusion of actually adding value that doesn't add any value. And I still remember it when I discovered this at my first brokerage, how much we were spending on print advertising with the local newspaper. And the local newspaper is the it's called the Ink and Mirror on Nantucket. The Inky M, I think, is the website. And the Ink and Mirror, we were spending thousands to every week, every month. I can't remember. It was a big number just to put our listings in the paper and to put our agents' faces next to those listings. And in my almost 3 years of living on that island, guess how many deals we did that people saw it in the paper? Yeah, goose egg. None. We also paid money to put it in fancy printed the listings in fancy printed magazines that were distributed around the island. Again, nobody calls and says, I want this listing because I saw it in the magazine. The same is true pretty much for everywhere you see print listings. It's extremely rare. So why do agents spend enormous amounts of money, even up to the Wall Street Journal, paying to put their listing in there, paying to advertise that your listing is getting international distribution? Well, the reason is they're trying to justify their commissions. They're trying to give you the impression as a seller that they're doing something when actually they're not. This does not result in my 20 years of experience, this particular method of distribution does zero. There's extremely unlikely possibility that someone's picking up the phone because they saw this tiny postage stamp photo of your house with a few details on the price. And they're like, that's the house, and picks it up and calls. It might be how they begin a relationship with a broker, because they do see a house that's interesting and they're like, let me go look at this one. Maybe they call a broker and that face is next to it. And that broker uses that as an opportunity to recruit a new buyer. Mm. But the odds of them buying that house, I mean, it's not quite lottery odds, but it's probably 2%, 3%. It's extremely low. So in this conversation with this agent, I told him about the podcast that we've covered this in depth. And I really, you know, it's not just Compass. Let me be clear that there's other brokerages and there's other brokers who I won't name specifically that pretend that will blow smoke and have funhouse mirrors at you about how this private networking thing results in their clients getting the deal, right? Their client will get the exclusive on the house because of this private pocket listing. And we've covered clear cooperation and the laws in Colorado, as well as many other states that prohibit this sort of in-house trading of listings that require you, the moment you mention it to your email list, you need to 24 hours later have it on the MLS. And it can be in coming soon status, but you can't hoard it to yourself. Right. And the real estate industry has all of these rules to create clear cooperation because it benefits the sellers. It also benefits the buyers. It maximizes sale price. You don't do that typically at a private deal. But I tried to explain this to the client, and I told him these numbers, this friend and past client, the numbers are really, really low. I don't actually have them, but I could tell you it's extremely unlikely. Like, what happened with you buying in California is, first, are you sure that it wasn't marketed to somebody else? And are you sure you didn't overpay for it? Because what I tell my sellers is, look, if I bring you a deal that's pre-market, that one of my clients wants it or has heard about it on a whisper, they should pay more than market for the privilege of locking in an exclusive deal before it hits market. There's a premium for homes that, and unless you're convinced you're getting more than you think it's worth, you should never take a private market deal. Somebody is losing money here. Mm-hmm. And the buy side, it's the same conversation. If I'm lucky enough to find you a deal before it hits the market through my network, you should be prepared to pay more than this house is probably worth, because that's what's expected for the privilege of getting it.
The exclusivity. Like,
yeah. You don't know if maybe it would have sold for more or not, and you will never know. So it's better to assume that it would have sold for less than you're paying for it if you want to play the pre-market game. But the pre-market game itself is deeply regulated and is considered unethical, because somebody is getting screwed.
Yeah.
Somebody is leaving money on the table. It's either the buyer or the seller. And that's because the market has not seen the house. So it's usually in the seller's best interest to let the market fully see the house, because there might have been somebody willing to pay more and you won't even know, right, until you put the house on the market. However, private deals happen. So I was thinking about this overnight, and this morning I decided with you to just let's go ahead and crunch the numbers. So I pulled down all of the sales in Boulder, and they also included Denver, but Denver's data set's only 6 months because of the MLS sharing agreement. But Boulder went back all the way to 2022 and looked at deals that were over $3 million, and both attached and detached, and dumped it into a spreadsheet, about 400 transactions, and looked at what percentage of those deals are double-ended, meaning that the buyer represented both, sorry, the listing agent represented both the seller and also was either, they either were exclusive to the seller or they were a transaction broker in the deal. And that's very specific language for the state of Colorado. Those are the only two positions. Well, I guess they could be a customer, but that's still representing the seller, right? If you're the listing agent and somebody wants to be a customer in the transaction. But in the MLS, this person will show up on both the buy side and the sell side. And of those 400 deals, it was about 10%. So 90% of the deals at the high end in Boulder since 2022 have been sold with a different buyer's agent from the listing agent. So you have only 10% probability of double ending. And then all the ethical conflicted issues around double ending, which isn't even like this could be a deal that was marketed to the public and double ended, right? We're not just talking about pre-market deals.
It's not a guarantee.
It's not a guarantee. And then I looked at Compass specifically because I was so annoyed by their constant marketing at their private client network and then how this is just contrary to the spirit and ethics of clear cooperation. And it's just annoying me. And I will say
it's brash.
Very clearly, this is my personal opinion, right? About a company's business practices. It's not about any specific agents within the company. But I've got a problem with this pretending to have a private network that you then use to solicit listings when it's actually not the case that this is a high probability circumstance. So here in Boulder, the top agents that joined Compass were all top agents before they joined Compass. The first wave of agents that joined them were in the top of their game to begin with, and Compass gave them some pretty sweet deals to join. And I don't know the specifics of those deals. There's a rumor mill around them. It doesn't matter. Supposedly, it involves stock options and cash bonuses. And if you look at Compass's financial reporting, their stock performance is a whole other story. But if you look at their S1, you look at their initial filings, they talk about that. They talk about how they incentivized top performing agents as a strategy for growth. It totally makes sense when you're dealing with public market money, IPO money. You've got a ton of money to go spend and you're trying to grow really fast. Your mission is to grow and you expect to lose lots of money. And that was Compass's growth curve. I don't know if they're going to survive or not. That's a whole nother topic. I used to be a stock analyst and that's a totally different discussion. But one thing that was clear from reading some of their filings where they were incentivizing agents. And so what I explained to my client is that these top agents were top agents before Compass. It's not because of Compass's branding. And some of them are really good at service, but most of them are really, really good at marketing. And our mission is to not let the marketing get ahead of the service level. We are investing a lot of money in marketing homes and our videography and pushing it across socials, advertising it across socials. And something you said earlier, you don't even see any other agents doing this.
Right.
And we're doing it because we want people to see it locally as much as possible. And it's not print advertising that's a little postage stamp. It is three-axis gimbal videography, professionally produced with great music. It's also smart buy videos that encourage people to consider neighborhoods they hadn't considered before. And we are paying to advertise that because that does add value both to the seller and to our brokerage. But we're not going to let our service level get behind our marketing level. And that is a mandate. Like our marketing is great. I think we're in the top of our game, but we cannot grow any faster than we can adequately and professionally serve our clients. And that's our number one mission, is to take care of our clients. Always. Now, with all of that said, because Compass's marketing annoyed me so much, and again, I'm going to say it again, this is my personal opinion, I went and dumped all of the sales from Boulder into that spreadsheet, and then we just looked at Compass deals. And of the 400 or so transactions, it looked like Compass agents on both end of the deal, right? So buy side and sell side, were 5.9% of high-end deals in Boulder since 2022. Now, that's not high-end. That's not the same agent double-ending. That's different. No, it's the same, it's different. So it included both. Yeah. Yeah, the brokerage. So within the private client network, if you will, that represented less than 6%. So 94% of high-end transactions are not in the Compass network. So when you ask yourself, I'm choosing the Compass network, but I'm choosing my Compass agent because of this supposed amazing benefit of private client network, I want you to remember that number. 94% of high-end transactions in Boulder are not in the Compass network. So is it really, even if it's true that they are allowed to, and I think this is a gray area because there's such a large brokerage, are they allowed to have within the brokerage only listings? Mm. You know, that's a matter for the real estate commission to go opine on. But even if they are, one, you've limited the number of people that can see the house, and two, 94% of transactions are not in this magic network.
Yeah.
So are you as a seller really getting the benefit of this? Is it really worth it to choose this agent? And I will add in that I've gotten to work with some fantastic Compass agents. Not all smoke and mirrors with them. There's incredible competency, but that's true of other brokerages too. The brand name on the brokerage is almost irrelevant. And so what you need to look at are what are the actual services you're getting if you're choosing a listing?
The true deliverables.
What are they doing? What's that?
The true deliverables, like the tangible.
The true deliverables. Yeah. I mean, we started adding a detailed multi-page marketing and communications plan with what we actually do. And I'll credit my client for encouraging me. I don't want to embarrass him by naming him, but this was maybe 7 years ago. We listed and sold his home in Mapleton Hill. And this house, it was like his third or fourth transaction with us. And he's like, Osman, I want to know what you're actually going to do. I want a plan. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, I want the follow-up plan too. Like if it doesn't sell right away, what happens? I was like, okay. And so I wrote it out. And what we do is we call for feedback from every single showing. We analyze the market pretty much weekly and sometimes biweekly if we're slammed, but we're looking at the market constantly and we're not waiting. We're not using automated feedback tools only because they're lame. And the percentage of people that respond to automated emailed feedback is almost zero. Mm-hmm. So you have to call these agents usually within a day or two of the showing to find out what they really thought of it, what their client thought of it, and is there the possibility of a deal? And you have to constantly benchmark your listing against the competition. It doesn't mean you adjust your pricing. Maybe somebody has dramatically undercut the market and wants to dump their house on, you know, and get it sold and doesn't care that they're losing money to do so. Maybe you let that listing go, but you know nothing's going to happen until that better house for less money sells. And you don't know that unless you benchmark.
Right.
How do you know if you don't benchmark? We currently have three active listings going and two more coming. I do personally. Sophie and Ian have their own coming. And every single one of them, we went and looked at the competition personally, including the one in Breckenridge. Even though it's only $500,000 deal, I drove up there because it was a new competitor. And I was like, I need to go see this thing. And what they didn't show you in the marketing and the photos was that it's above a liquor store on a roundabout. And no one's going to, like, compared to our listing that's true ski in, ski out, this was a joke. And they were priced very similarly. And once we knew that for sure, we could feel really confident in keeping our pricing where it was. But mm-hmm. without that drive to Breck, wasn't going to happen. And I'm not trying to just tout my own horn here, but you have to go see the competition constantly if you're going to accurately price your listing and serve your clients. And that's in our marketing and communications plan. So is the videography. So is all the boosting and the socials we're going to do. Open houses are a possibility. I've started to do them again. I've got mixed feelings, but there's older agents in the industry that tell me you need to keep doing open houses. They're worth it. So we're doing them again. But that's all laid out. Mm-hmm. It's not the smoke and mirrors, the Osman private client network. Osman and Hamish secret society of real estate buyers are going to magically pay more for your house.
We sent it out. We'll let you know. You know, it's like, here's exactly what we're doing.
I mean, if I had a guess, I would say 90% of the agents out there, and it's probably higher. Most people... if you know me, you know I tend to guess on the conservative side. I would say it's 90% or higher are doing minimal effort in accurately pricing, are doing minimal effort in high-end videography and marketing distribution, and are doing minimal effort in soliciting feedback and benchmarking your home continually against the competition. And you could see this in poor quality photos. You could see this in listings that aren't getting many showings. They're just sitting there, and we can easily see how they're mispriced. It's it's sort of a travesty, but that's also because the average agent does 3.5 deals a year and people do business with those they trust. And then brands like Compass and RE/MAX and Coldwell Banker and Liv Sotheby's have a brand that suggests competency. Mm. And I can assure you, and I'm energized by this, right? This whole topic has me pretty excited.
Yeah.
The relationship between the brand presence and the competency of the agent is broken. There is no relationship for the vast, we are an exception. We are a tiny brokerage. There are four of us, we're five just until we lost Grant, on the team. And I can assure you, every single one of us are deeply competent. We know what we're doing and we bring professional skills to the table. But that is not necessarily the case with warehouses of agents at Compass, RE/MAX, Coldwell Banker, you name it. They have hundreds of agents, thousands of agents nationally. And often these are part-time people that got into the real estate business as a second career. And the vast majority don't survive. Like the failure rate is something like 75% or 80% within 3 years.
Yep.
That's the truth about the real estate industry and brand names and brokerages. And the private network idea is pretty savvy and is 100% in the gray area.
It's good marketing.
Clear cooperation. It's, yeah.
But the results Osmond and Hamish secret
society.
Yeah.
List with us and we'll bring out the secret society of the private network.
You're just going to have to trust private. It's going to work, right? Like
it's sort of like Uber had, you know, the Uber limo service versus regular Uber. And Uber is a taxi that is socially driven.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, when they first launched, they really were trying to market themselves as an exclusive high-end experience. Until Lyft came along and started eating their lunch, and suddenly they were like, "Uber's for everyone. We're no longer exclusive. Everyone could get an Uber. We were just kidding."
And that's the benefit of competition, and that's why these, you know, whisper networks are so gray and generally frowned upon, is because it removes competition. And if you remove competition, you end up hurting the consumer or the client or the buyer or the seller. You're removing ability for the true market to work. And that's the whole point of all this, right? You know?
I mean, I think that's true across the board. Mm-hmm. Luxury marketing has some nuance to it. So base level marketing 101 is price it right, position it correctly against your competitors, and then market it well. Mm. In photography, there's a story. In the distribution of your marketing, your content marketing needs to be in the right place. Like you wouldn't show an advertisement for the newest luxury BMW in like a cheap, you know, periodical. You wouldn't do it, right? It doesn't make sense. But would you put that into a newspaper or a magazine or a video program that caters to affluent buyers? And there's a reason Rolex advertises.
I was just about to use
Wimbledon.
Rolex.
Okay. Yeah. Rolex doesn't advertise at the NASCAR races. Mm-hmm. They advertise at F1. Tennis events and Formula One because of who the audience is. So you do need to know where your distribution is going, and you do need to produce content professionally, marketing professionally. And frankly, you have to pay to distribute. Mm-hmm. And this is what most agents are reluctant to even pay for professional photography, much less spend thousands of dollars on videography and then spend thousands on top of that pushing it across the region. Like, and that's the nice thing about social media, is we can keep our marketing at least
super local,
close to, yeah, super local relative to what people paying for the Wall Street Journal are doing.
Yeah.
So it's not rocket science, but the nuance is in addition to pricing it right and professionally produced content, it's also in the benchmarking, it's also making sure you're distributing to the right channels and with the right messaging for where that home fits into the spectrum of options for buyers. And under $1 million is not a luxury listing anymore, but above three is. Mm. And it really needs to be carefully managed. And kudos for the private client secrecy club to create this illusion of amazing exclusivity, but it's not. 94% of deals, at least here in Boulder, since 2022, are not private client network deals.
Yeah. They're outside of the secret club. Yeah.
So if you want to focus on the 6% of the market that's going to potentially be your deal size, or your footprint, then go for it. But otherwise, don't believe the hype. And it's not to say, again, I'll reiterate again, there are amazing Compass agents. There are amazing agents at every brokerage. And I will frequently name those people who I really enjoy working with, who are professional, clearly represent their clients to the best of their interest. But forget about the name on the brokerage. It literally is irrelevant to the level of competency.
Yeah. Focus on the action. Focus on the deliverables. Focus on what you actually see happen, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And all the listings are on the Magic Listing Service, the
MLS. Yeah.
If you are a member of the MLS, which all brokerages are that are legit brokerages, I'm a personal member of 4 MLSs.
Yeah.
When you're on the MLS, you have to obey the rules of the MLS. And that means all of your deals are on the MLS, even if it's a pocket deal. You've got to put it on the MLS, otherwise you're in violation of the rules. And the large brokerages are way more careful about that, which is why you see occasionally these double-ended deals appear, sold before it hit the market. You see them. And my initial conclusion is always, oh, I wonder if it was the buyer or the seller who overpaid or got less. Who left money on the table? Was it the buyer or the seller? Somebody did. And maybe it made sense to do so, right? You knew you had to move in within a certain time frame. This was the house. You flew in just this weekend. Mm-hmm. Whatever the story is, there's a reason why for you it was worth overpaying or leaving money on the table. Maybe you wanted a simple and fast sale, and this person said, I can close in 2 weeks cash, and they flew in. You don't have to deal with showings in your house, people walking around your home, looking in your closet, touching your things. Like, you don't have to worry about all those things.
What?
You're done, and maybe it's worth it.
What percentage? Because I imagine it's such a fractionally small point at this level and where the market's at of how these, I guess, private sales are still, you know, a neighbor meets another neighbor and it's like, I'm going to buy that house if you ever sell it. And then they cut a deal. Like, that's got to be such a small fraction.
It happens.
Yeah.
It's a small fraction. It does happen. There was an attorney in our industry named Oliver Frescona who advised us for many years here locally in Boulder. He was amazing. He was funny. He had a really cool handlebar mustache. Uh-huh. He was a character, but really smart and had such great presentation skills. But he called, you know, what would happen is somebody would, let's say you were serious and I wanted to buy your house, Hamish. I'd say, okay, look, grant me a first right of refusal. I'll pay you $1,000, but this is in perpetuity. If you ever go enlist the home, I want the option to buy it.
Yeah.
And Oliver used to call that person who got the first right of refusal, and often they wouldn't even pay $1,000. They would just, you would grant it for free, which is nuts, but you would grant it to me for free. They would call me the person getting the right of first refusal. They would call that person that screws up the deal for the eventual buyer, who makes it more difficult for the eventual buyer to acquire the home.
Yeah.
Because you would go to list the home, and you would find a buyer, and then you'd have to deal with me screwing up your deal.
Humming and hawing.
And making your deal more complicated. Yeah, making it harder for the real buyer to close. That's what the first right of refusal largely is.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, that message has gotten there. That's why if you search first right of refusal on the MLS, entire MLS, there's like 2 at any given time from people that didn't know better and granted somebody a first right.
Noted.
Although with that said, some HOAs, like our Breck deal, have a built-in first right.
Mm-hmm.
There was no option. That was part of it. The association owners have a first right of refusal. That was how their legal structure works.
Yeah. And we're talking about like the kind of a buddy structure as well, you know. So it's a little different.
It happens. But again, you're not sure you're getting market if you sell to your buddy. And it's awkward, right? Like your buddy said, you agreed to sell it to me for $500,000. Well, it's worth $1 million today.
Yeah, that's a rough one.
So how are we going to work this out?
Yeah.
I saw a fantastic negotiation technique from my re-Twitter people. And I want to share this with you, Hamish, primarily. But everyone else can benefit from this as well. And this negotiation technique is brilliant. And the guy goes, I wish I could cite it because I can't remember his name, but he says, okay, seller wants $2 million and you offer $1 million and seller says, what, are you crazy? It's worth 2. And you say, okay, I'll sell it back to you in a year for 1.1. And if you really think it's worth 2, you can buy it back in a year for 1.1. And I, as a buyer, get my 10% for owning it for a year. It's a win-win. You get cash for whatever you need to buy right now.
Oh, that's clever.
You know you need to buy something. It's super clever.
Yeah.
And so I get it. That makes so much sense. And in this market where rates are so high and sellers are need to sell and buyers are very cautious, this is one approach actually I may be trying with with one of my acquisitions coming up with a past client. With full disclosure, like, you know, the comps suggest like a 650-ish price, but nothing is close to cash flowing on this thing for 650. Hmm. Like, in order to make the numbers work, it's probably got to be like 575. So maybe I'll offer to buy it at 575. And if he wants to buy it back in a year because he feel like he got screwed, he can buy it back at a 10% perk in a year.
Easy.
Like, give me 10% more, you can have it back.
Yeah.
That's a good deal. It's a good deal for everybody. You think it's worth 625 or 650. I can't get the numbers to work with that number.
I don't disagree. Yeah.
And I don't want, you know, and it's fully disclosed. It's not hidden. It's not like there's shadiness going on. It's on the table. Mm-hmm. This is the deal.
Yeah. And the numbers are obvious.
And we're not trying to hide anything.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll just list it for the 625 or 650. And if we don't get a buyer, then we can look at that option. We might get a buyer. It's actually, there might be, this is a
that
C
unit
kitty
is
condo.
Very
might
cool.
Be. It's cool. It's yeah. Total. It's a great. It's a gem of a unit at Gold Run. It makes total sense, but the cost of capital is so high that I literally had to put like 60% down to get it to cash flow. Like, that doesn't yeah. make sense. But especially when your cash is sitting there earning 5%, doing nothing, no risk.
That's
zero risk is 5%.
That's a two bet, isn't it?
It is a two bet.
Yeah.
You want a partner on it, Hamish? You ready for your second deal?
I wish. That is a cool, cool unit. I'll scrape together
a good some little investment unit.
Yeah, I could probably get.
Has some. A new air conditioner. Has nice floors. Has a good layout. Has a garage parking space. I wish it was on the top floor, but then it would be like 700. Mm-hmm. So,
regardless.
All right, we are at an hour and 12 minutes or so. What have we failed to cover? Let's wrap this up.
Goodbye, Grant. Pocket listings. House.
Pocket listings. Your new house. We yeah. covered our three major topics.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll wrap this up with I am Osman at House Einstein, houseeinstein.com. You will find my personal socials online. You'll also find the company's activities online. If you find a lag in our marketing, it's because we're focused on our clients. That's usually why the newsletter has paused. But we do have a newsletter as well that we do try to get to. It's called Fresh Listings. You'll find it on the House Einstein website at houseeinstein.com. Check out our YouTube. Check out our Instagram. Drop us a note. Send us a smoke signal.
We're everywhere.
If you're buying or if you're buying or selling in Boulder or Denver or Breckenridge or Grand County or Summit County, Longmont, Erie, Lafayette, Louisville, this is our core market. We've gone as far north as Fort Collins and as far south as
Springs.
Colorado Springs. I've done deals in Buena Vista, and those are deals outside of my personal footprint, or usually because people want to work with me specifically. But we now have agents that are covering a large swath of Colorado, and hopefully we'll continue to expand. That's our mission, is to grow the company, but our primary mission is also to help buyers and sellers make smarter real estate decisions.
Yep.
So thanks for joining the House Einstein podcast.
I've been Hamish.
Okay. Still are Hamish.
Yep.
And we'll catch you next time. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Take care.